John Quadi's book on statistical mechanics. It says there, and that's true, that lots of the stuff I did, I got out of Wikipedia, and I found it to be accurate and very good for making sure that one gets plus I rather than minus I in all the right places. Okay, first I ought to find out something about you all. Let's figure out how many of you have taken a course in statistical physics previously? Essentially everybody, okay? How many of you have taken a course which included thermodynamics? Essentially everybody. Have you had, do you know about how one describes fermions in statistical physics? Yes, some of you do, many of you do. Okay, let's figure out what level of mathematics you've had. How many of you had a course in partial differential equations? About half. Ordinary differential equations? Many, many, many. How many of you had a course, not the first course, which includes some, but a specific course on electricity and magnetism? Classical mechanics. Well-educated bunch. Okay, let me then try to figure out where you all come from. How many of you are from Europe? Asia? Africa? North America? South America? We got everybody. No penguins here, as far as I can tell. But aside from that, we have everything represented. No, Australia. I haven't done Australia. Hey, way to go. New Zealand comes under Australia sometimes, but I guess we don't have any New Zealanders. Nothing from Oz. Okay. Let's go on. Okay, I'm going to start out talking about the ideas that belong to statistical physics. You all have taken quantum mechanics and classical mechanics, and you all know some of the things that apply in those subjects. However, classical mechanics and quantum mechanics are mostly in their original invention aimed at systems containing a few particles. My colleague, Phil Anderson, pointed out that in a paper in Science that more is different. That is, the systems containing large numbers of particles have an essentially different behavior from systems containing a few particles. That's one of the reasons we teach statistical mechanics as a separate subject from classical mechanics or quantum mechanics. The field theory that you were hearing about in the previous lecture is all about what goes on when you have many particles. It is set up to deal with many particles and set up to deal with specific problems that arise with enlarged systems with large numbers of particles. Let me talk to you for just a moment about concepts which apply in the situation in which there are many particles and don't apply when there are just a few. For example, temperature. You cannot talk about the concept of temperature unless you have lots of things happening. Okay, that's not the only concept that applies only when there are many particles around. You can tell me some more, I bet. Anybody have any ideas about other concepts which apply mostly when there are many particles around? Pressure, great, way to go. Okay, what about other concepts? Right on, others. Okay, what about the idea of when you use electrodynamics, you talk about fields B and H, D and E. Does that make sense if you don't have a material around? Those concepts, the concepts of having those fields, basically make use of the fact that there are lots and lots of electrons producing the electromagnetic fields. Many, many other concepts that you're used to thinking about reach out and demand that you have many particles around. You just heard about something about the derivation of sound waves. Well, sound waves don't occur when there are three particles or four particles or five. They only occur when you have a very large number of particles around. So when Anderson says, more is different, what he means is that you have situations in which you have things that are essentially different from what happens in systems with a few particles. Let me give you an example. This is an example from Christian Huygens, who was basically a builder of clocks, among other things, and looked, this is his picture. It's a little primitive looking, but indeed this describes his experiment, which was done in the 17th century, in which you had two clocks. You had them hanging off of a wooden plank, and the wooden plank was supported on two chairs, as you see. These two clocks, after you let them sit there for a few minutes or a few hours, ended up synchronized. Their pendula went click, 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 but I'm not sure I can do it, but the two pendula went click, click, click together. They were synchronized in their motion. In fact, it is broadly true that clocks and metronomes, you put a couple of metronomes up on the piano, and first it's very annoying because the metronomes click off at different intervals. However, after a little bit of time, the metronomes get together and click together. Why does this happen? Well, we can calculate how it happens from looking at the laws of classical mechanics. You write down the equations for two pendula within classical mechanics, and indeed you can describe this in a four-dimensional phase space. You have the equations obeyed by the pendula, so you have a first pendulum and a second pendulum, and they have a second time derivative, which is the frequency of the first one times the frequency of the second one. And if you have the sine of the angle and the sine of the angle, and then maybe you put a spring in, you think of this plank as a spring connecting the two pendula. So maybe you have k times theta 1 minus theta 2 here. And since the forces on the two pendula are opposite, you have k times theta 1 minus theta 2 there. And maybe these two guys are different. And maybe omega 1 squared is approximately equal to omega 2 squared, but not quite equal. So these two pendula start out with slightly different frequencies. And after a while, you observe that they both come to the same frequency, that they both come to a frequency omega. Then you go back and calculate from these equations. Would you get this locking from the equations? Come on, you guys have all taken short answer tests. You know that I would not ask you the question if that equation gave you the locking in an obvious and direct, straightforward way. So the answer to my question is no. But don't be shy. Please try to participate. You can see that the answer is no in the following way. This system exists in a four-dimensional phase space. There are two derivatives here and two derivatives there, so there are four dimensions. If we then fix the energy of this two-pendulum system, we have what's left is a three-dimensional space. If you figure out how big a space it is in which the two pendula have locked together in this three-dimensional space, there's a three-dimensional space, there's one axis and another axis and another axis. In this three-dimensional space, there is a line, infinitely thin, which describes the portion of that phase space in which these pendula are locked together. If, however, you do the experiment, in doing the experiment, you have to not look at the equations. Instead, you look at the clocks. If you look at the clocks, you find that there's a whole region of space, of this space, in which the things get locked together. These equations are misleading. These simple classical mechanics equations are misleading in that they do not lead directly in a robust in a way with a volume in the space in which this synchronization occurs. What have I left out?
What happens if we include friction?
Right on. If we include friction, so we include friction, and we then say that these equations of classical mechanics per se don't exactly work because we need an effect which depends upon the existence of many particles. We need an effect which does not have the same structure as the equations of classical mechanics. We need to invoke effects which occur because, in fact, the system is composed of many particles. Friction is one example of a many-particle effect which is not included in the simplest classical mechanics or quantum mechanics treatment. There are other examples. I'm going to talk for a moment about something else that shows up, not exactly the same way, but almost the same way, what is called the butterfly effect. A man by the name of Ed Lorenz, a person who studied weather, geophysical scientist, studied a simple model for the behavior of weather in a separated region of space. His simple model had three equations in it. The next slide has those three equations. I'll show them to you. Oh, I put this up on a computer. Here's sort of the computer program. We have a three-dimensional space in which there is a R, Rx, Ry, Rz, and that three-dimensional variable R describes what goes on in this simplified model of the weather. The time derivative of R has, for the term in dx dt, here it is, it has 8/3 of the x component plus the y component times the z component. And there's a minus sign in front of the x, the 8/3. The time dy dt is proportional to the y component and proportional to the z component. Dz dt, well, there it is. I don't have to read it to you. This is a very simple set of equations, and Lorenz put it up on his simple-minded computer of the 1960s. That computer had considerably less power to it than your hand calculator. In fact, it had so little power to it, you could hardly imagine it. I did the same thing with language called Pascal, and I'm about to show you, if I have any luck, what comes out from this computer calculation. It produces a complex flow, which I'm about to show you with a little bit of luck. Oh, come on, stand up. I can't even get the stick to stand up. No less. Show you what's going on. Okay, so we do a hide, and we look under the file called Lorenz, and we have Lorenz 1 orbit, and it opens up, and then you push F5 and cross your fingers. Crossing your fingers is absolutely necessary. And okay, now what's going on here? Help! Why am I showing the desk on my computer when I'm not showing the desk here? Okay, look, I don't really need the computer. I can do this myself without the computer. Things aren't working. Things never work when you expect them to. Here is a beautiful universe, but it's not the universe I want to be in. I want to be in the universe of the Lorenz equations, in which there is a space X, Y, Z. I guess it's hidden behind the desk, but that's okay. I'm just going to wave my hands around. What happens is that the solution to the equation, which I can see in front of me on my computer, but is this on the screen, the solution to the equations is that there are two points, and around two different points, thank you for rescuing me, some awful thing has happened, and I don't know what it is. Oh, I bet I could. No? What the, oh, well. Let me tell you what's going on. There we go. Wise people can do good things.
There you go.
Okay, get me back this picture is the one I wanted. Okay, I now wave my hands around with a picture in front of me. This is a picture of a three-dimensional space. There's a swirling motion around this point. It goes around this point for a while. Then it decides to go around a point up there and swirls around that point for a while, and then comes back here doing a complicated thing like that. That was instructive, but not so tremendously instructive. What the instructive thing that happened was when the day in which he looked at two separate orbits, starting out from tiny bit different initial positions. When he did that, and I'm still not confident the computer is going to do it, so I'll do it with my hands. He did that, the two points, there they are, started out and they worked together. They went around and around, and then they went around the other place and did that a couple of times, and then came back to there, and then they were doing slightly different things until after a while they were doing entirely different things. Okay, that's something of a surprise. The big surprise, however, is something that you, as students of physics and mathematics, could understand, namely that the points, which started out very close together, separated from one another in an exponential fashion. As time went on, they got exponentially far away from one another. That is that the equations that Lorenz was dealing with produced exponential separation of orbits with infinitesimally different initial conditions. That was unexpected. It never happens in simple classical mechanics. It never happens in simple quantum mechanics. This exponential separation of orbits is a property of other kinds of systems, but not of classical mechanics or quantum mechanics. Yes?
Between them in phase space, or?
What? The separation goes the following way. You start out an infinitesimal distance apart. You go on in time and they get further apart. You then measure the distance in phase space. That distance, as they are close together, grows exponentially in time. That sharp enough answer? Yes, please.
Double pendulums also exhibit chaotic behavior, and that's purely double pendulums?
But double pendulums go through chaotic behavior, and it is exactly the same sort of thing if you have friction in it, and different if you do not. If you do not have friction in it, the what happens is that the double pendulum I'm trying to remember now. Double pendulum do indeed do as you I do not believe that you're correct. I think it's wrong, but I'm at the moment somewhat confused. Let me apologize for being confused. I think what happens is that you have, no, you're right and I'm wrong. I take it back. The double pendulum will do that. And indeed, there are examples of hyperbolic elliptic, blah, 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 blah. Rhetoric evaporates. I'm not exactly sure whether I'm right or wrong, so I will then tell you what happened in the intellectual world where I know what the right answer is, and then come back after I think about it a little bit more to tell you about what happened in the physical world. Intellectual world, people believed that you could predict the future. Those of you who are readers of science fiction know Isaac Asimov's stuff about the social scientists who predict the future and then try to manipulate the world in order to make a better future. That is because up until the time that Lorenz worked, people believed that if you change things a little bit, that would change the future only in a slow and predictable way. This Lorenz calculation, which showed the butterfly effect, what is called the butterfly effect, Lorenz described that as the flapping of a butterfly in South America could, in a couple of weeks' time, change the weather in Texas. That butterfly effect, in which tiny changes magnified themselves and produced huge results, was not expected to be happening in the real world systems. These real world systems were expected to behave in a fashion which small changes were indeed small changes were indeed produced small effects and algebraic growth of separations of orbits. This exponential growth of separations of orbits changed the point of view of everybody towards the predictability of the future. Lorenz, with his simple three-equation model, was able to then change the intellectual point of view of people around the world. Now I'm going to come back to your question about the double pendulum. In classical mechanics, there are situations in which there are ordinary behaviors and exceptional behaviors. Exceptional behaviors occur when orbits let me describe the analogous effect in a single pendulum and why the behavior you describe in a double pendulum is exceptional. In a single pendulum, if I have a motion and I change it a little bit, the growth of the effect of that change is in time is only algebraic. However, there is one special situation in which you get exponential growth. If I have the pendulum sticking straight up like that, and I move it a little bit, that little bit of motion of change causes an effect which grows exponentially. There are special points in the motion in which you moving away from those special points, you get exponential growth. For the pendulum, that special point is pointing straight up, for example. Whereas if you start out with it pointing this way and change things a little bit, that will only produce an algebraic change in time. So this gentleman over here was right, and I was wrong, in the sense that sometimes in classical mechanics, you do indeed get exponential separation of orbits. But I was also sort of right, in that that is an exceptional situation which occurs only with special configurations in classical mechanics, configurations which are exceptional.
So in the case of the double pendulum,
there are initial conditions which produce exponential separations of orbits. They're not generic. However, because the double pendulum is so has such a complicated motion, in fact, in practice, this gentleman was right. In practice, you come often enough, close enough to special points, so that in practice, the double pendulum is indeed chaotic. In principle, however, if I start out at look at great detail at what happens if I have infinitesimal separation of initial conditions in the double pendulum, and I continue over long periods of time, I have to come very close to one of these special points in the orbit before I begin to get exponential separation. Exponential separation is an exceptional property of classical mechanics and a generic property of the Lorentz system. The change in point of view towards the world, then, is that exponential separation is as generic as friction in the real world. If you want to do politics or social science, you better believe in exponential separation. You better believe that small changes can indeed produce big effects. And that entire change was produced by a study of a simple model which did things in a three-dimensional space. What I'm then trying to describe to you is a kind of science in which the study of simple models can change our point of view towards the world. In particular, Lorentz's simple model was one of the most important developments of 20th century science, rating not quite up to the double helix, but rating very high in what would had important effects on our view of ourselves and the world. Similarly, other things that happen in simple models reflect things that can happen generically in the world and then reflect what is what we think about what the world is like. Since the computer seems to have failed me, this is not what I see up on my computer screen. And I'm not quite sure why it's not what I'm up, what I see on my computer screen. I'm going to switch away from the computer. I'm told that if I push this button, which says off, I am no longer dependent upon the technology of the 20th or 21st centuries. I'm told. I pushed it. Yes, I'm no longer dependent on the technology of the 20th or 21st century. I can go back to classical methods and work on the blackboard, and we'll do that and feel much less stressed by technology. So I want to start telling you something about statistical physics, something with less bullshit content. instead of talking about these models, I will talk to you about something very simple indeed, dice. Now, if you take an ordinary die, it has six sides. And if you roll it, you have a probability which is equal for coming up on all of the different sides. Let's label a result by alpha and talk about the relative probability. R is a relative probability. Of finding alpha coming up, alpha being one or two or three or four or five or six, depending on which side comes up. In fact, the relative probability, if you work in a society in which people are honest, that relative probability is one. Don't try that on the streets of New York, however. You should know better than that. Now, if you want to calculate what the total probability of rho is, what we call the probability of finding the event alpha, and that probability is defined in the following way. Imagine that you flipped a die a very large number of times, n times, and the number of times that alpha came up is n alpha, and the total number of times that you flip the dice is n, and you're working in the limit as n goes to infinity. We know what the answer is. The answer is that rho alpha is proportional to r alpha, and there's some constant of proportionality which makes it this into a probability. That constant of proportionality is called z, and is called a partition function. And we're going to be spending the next 2 days talking about partition functions. The partition function is defined so that this probability obeys the sum over alpha of rho alpha is equal to one. That's one of the two conditions on probabilities. The other condition on the on a probability is that all probabilities are greater than or equal to zero. This then defines what the science of probabilities is about in mathematical terms. In this case, in which we have a crapshoot, in which we have die, we know what this partition function is going to turn out to be. What you want to have is the sum over the six possible cases alpha equals 1 to 6 of the relative probability, which is independent of alpha divided by z, that you want this sum, which is then going to be 6 times r over z, to be equal to 1. And so you want the relative probability to be equal to, if you choose the simple situation in which the relative probability is equal to 1, this is the only thing you could say a priori, is that the relative probabilities are all the same, but you might as well choose it to be equal to 1. Then you get the value of the partition function is equal to 6. Okay, that's the way things work out with dice. And we can go through a whole long song and dance about how probabilities work out with dice. But let's jump immediately to classical mechanics. In classical mechanics, we have a phase space which is given by the momenta and the coordinates of all of the particles in the system. There could be 3 of them, there could be 1 of them, there could be 10 to the 6th of them. That phase space has a volume element, d gamma, which is the product over all of the particles in the system, dpj, dqj. This is an infinitesimal volume in the phase space which describes classical mechanics. There is now an assumption which I am going to make following the great people in this subject, the great people being Gibbs, Boltzmann, Maxwell. That assumption is that a priori, you have an equal chance of being anywhere in phase space. There is an analogous statement that one makes. Okay, I'm told that I'm supposed to be able to do something here. Oh, well, I have to stick my finger out, and it tells me what I can do. So I want the front to go up. I have to put my finger on it. Bye-bye. Well, this is fun. Do I have to lecture? Maybe I should spend... Oh, well. Okay. I'll next do quantum mechanics. A priori, well, the probability of being in any state in quantum mechanics is the same as the probability of being in any other state. Now, that means that if you have some quantum mechanical system and you don't know anything else about it, the average of anything, okay, there's the statistical average, the average of anything is the sum over all the possible states, because in fact you have an equal probability of being in all of those states, divided by the total number of states. The alpha alpha is equal to 1. And this is our definition of what we say a priori about averages in quantum mechanics. That is, we say in quantum mechanics, the probability of being in any state alpha is equal to 1 divided by the total number of states. Now, this will work out fine if we have a system with a finite number of states. But in fact, in all of the most interesting examples, there are very, very large numbers of states. And these a priori rules don't work. One has to consider, in addition, the results of conservation laws. In particular, the conservation of energy is very important. If you dealt with the Hamiltonian that you saw in the last lecture, then you can go up to infinitely large energies for the systems being talked about by simply having an infinite amount of kinetic energy. Therefore, the volume of the phase space that you would be thinking about would be infinite. Similarly, in most quantum mechanical examples, you have an infinite number of states because the momentum has an infinite number of eigenstates. The masters, Gibbs and Boltzmann and Maxwell, in fact, started out by thinking about this problem of or this what happens because of energy conservation. And they said that the probability of anything, the relative probability of anything, would turn out to be proportional to the energy of that anything divided by kT. Beta is 1 over a constant called the Boltzmann constant times T, the absolute temperature, and said that this would be the relative probability, and that to calculate the average of anything, you then calculated a probability rho alpha, which is given by R alpha divided by some partition function, and that partition function was defined so that the rho alpha would satisfy, I guess I want this a little higher. Oh, other one. Nope. What's, oh, I see. Thank you. It refers to blackboards by their position in that coordinate, not that coordinate. Thank you. Okay, in order to get the normalization correct, we then define the partition function to be the sum over all states of e to the minus beta times the energy of that state. That's fine for quantum mechanics. This is the quantum mechanical blackboard. If I want to have a classical mechanics, I have to do something a little different. And in classical mechanics, what I do is demand that R alpha, alpha being proportional to the volume in infinitesimal volume in phase space, e to the minus beta times the energy at that piece of phase space. I demand that the partition function be the integral over all phase space of e to the minus beta times the energy at that point in phase space. I then say that the average of anything is 1 over the partition function times the integral over the phase space of e to the minus beta times the energy at that point in phase space. Thank you very much. If I don't get any help from my friends, and you all are my friends, I suspect, I'll make the most awful errors. So I need your help. There's no question about it. And my errors are your errors. If you let me make errors, I'm going to blame you all. So there. Okay. So this is the formulation of statistical mechanics. I could talk about more other conserved quantities, what happens in astrophysics when you have galaxies and you have conserved angular momentum. I could talk about lots of things, but basically, this is the formulation of the problem. Everything else is less fundamental. And so everything else is, you might say, a bore. That's not exactly so. Because of Anderson's statement that more is different, one expects now that one is going to see interesting results coming out, unexpected results coming out, because we have the possibility of talking about lots of different particles, because we can talk about an energy or a Hamiltonian, which is the sum over all the particles of the momentum squared divided by twice the mass of the particle, plus the sum over all pairs of particles of the potential energy depending on the difference between the coordinates of the particles. Because these sums can run up to very high values of n, we might expect to see unexpected behavior. Indeed, unexpected behavior is the thank you. Question. I could answer the question in several ways. One is historical. That is that people tried it and it worked. The other is less historical, but it's going to require a long song and dance. That is, the long song and dance basically has the following answer. If I assume that that happens for some things, and then I calculate what happens for other things, I will discover that the other things also obey the same law. So the assumption that this is the right behavior is generic. That is, you make the assumption and it then extends to other things. I will, around the sixth lecture or the seventh lecture, produce a derivation of this. However, the derivation is not at all simple. It is the hardest thing in this course. And I ask you, beg of you, that you accept this and we go on from there. Yes, please.
Extend it to other things, then the form is preserved?
Yes, there is this, what is called this Gibbs distribution, that's this thing with the exponential, or Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Gibbs is what mathematicians call it. Physicists say Maxwell-Boltzmann, but it's the same distribution. That is the thing which is preserved. If you assume, I'll describe very precisely what is preserved. If you have a big system, and I take a little system within it and say the little system is sort of weakly interacting with the big system, then it is, you can prove, no nonsense, you can prove that the little system has that behavior if the big one does. You could also go and prove if you have lots of little ones that this is what tends to happen sort of on the average if you have lots of little ones weakly interacting. You do two or three more cases like this, and you become reasonably well convinced that it's so. However, this gives me a chance to talk about what physicists do. Physicists make guesses, as Maxwell and Bolt. Maxwell made this guess first. Maxwell guessed it on the basis of what is called the barometer formula, which shows that if you go up in the atmosphere, this is more or less true. Once you make a guess as a physicist, you then apply it to all kinds of things and see whether that guess works. If it begins to seem to work, you stick with it as long as it seems to work. This is not like the mathematicians who need axioms and then proofs. You sort of wave your hands around at all times. But that's what physicists do, is wave their hands around at all times. So we are going to make this assumption, and we're going to follow up on the consequences of that assumption. Then, after using that assumption for quite a while, we will then show arguments which make it more plausible that the assumption is right. In fact, that's what happened historically. Maxwell assumed this on the basis of pretty flimsy arguments. Then, 30 or 40 years later, Boltzmann developed better arguments for it. Then, quantum mechanics was invented, and Boltzmann's arguments don't apply directly to quantum mechanics, but people still used the formula, and it works. Okay. Let me then say it works and go on and try to... Oh, that's a good one. I'll take that one. And go on to apply it to the simplest problem I can think about. The simplest problem I can think about has a Z component of a spin on a single atom, and that this Z component takes on the values plus and minus 1. I put this in a magnetic field. That magnetic field points in the Z direction and find a Hamiltonian, which is equal to the Bohr magnetron times the sigma Z times BZ, with a minus sign. And then I start talking about minus beta H, which is some coefficient times sigma Z. And that coefficient is the magnetic field in the Z direction times the Bohr magnetron times 1 over K Boltzmann constant times temperature. Now I'm in business. I can say that the relative probability of the two outcomes, plus and minus 1, is 1 times e to the minus beta, 1 being just what one assumes because the two spins directions are equally likely, times e to the minus beta times the Hamiltonian value when sigma z is plus or minus 1. Or that r is e to the h times sigma. The partition function is the sum over the two possible cases of this. So the partition function is e to the h, that's spin up, plus e to the minus h, that's spin down, plus 1, minus 1, which is twice the hyperbolic cosine of h. the probability then of having spin up is e to the beta h divided e to the h divided by z. And the probability of having spin down is e to the minus h divided by z. And that's all there is to this problem. The only remaining step is to use these probabilities to calculate an average. And the interesting average is the average of the spin. And let's go through this slow, because although it sounds trivial to calculate this, it is not trivial. This, you sum over possibilities. The value of the guy, depending on the different possibilities, times the probability, which is e to the h sigma divided by z. This sum over sigma is plus or minus 1 is e to the h minus e to the minus h, and we divide by z. And this average then is equal to the hyperbolic sine of h divided by twice the hyperbolic cosine of h, and that is equal to the hyperbolic tangent of h, tanha of h. For the first 70 years the statistical mechanics existed, people did calculations just like this and learned about things like what happens if you put a solid in a magnetic field. The solid has spins in it. Those spins get lined up in a magnetic field. I will do the analogous calculation for, well, let me go look at my notes. I got so enthusiastic. I haven't looked at my notes in ages, and I don't know where I should be. Oh, I know, I forgot something. When the computer collapsed around me, I lost one calculation that I should have done. Horace. Okay, I'm going to go back. I have to go back and do it on the blackboard, because in fact, so now you've learned how to do all kinds of calculations involving partition functions in statistical mechanics. I will do one more of those because it's directly relevant for the homework, and then we will. I will go on to talk about something else which is directly relevant for the homework. I have to catch up with the homework. You know, all know that one uses. For spin 1/2 particles, Pauli spin matrices, sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. Because I use sigma so much in the context in which I have sigma z, take sigma equal to plus or minus 1, instead of using the names sigma 1, sigma 2, and sigma 3, I will use tau 1, tau 2, and tau 3 for the Pauli spin matrices. So when I'm dealing with things called sigma, I won't worry much about commutation relations. However, as you know, the Pauli spin matrices obey the elegant commutation relation that tau j times tau k is the square root of minus 1 times epsilon jkl times tau l summed over l. That is that, for example, tau 1 times tau 2 is I times tau 3. Is this Is this unfamiliar to anyone here? Please tell me if it's unfamiliar to you. Okay. To describe, I won't say any more than that, but I will say it slightly more slowly. Instead of dealing with technology, I'll go do it on this blackboard. In order to describe a spin one-half particle, one describes it by using these matrices, tau 1, tau 2, and tau 3, which are called the Pauli spin matrices. They have two properties. In fact, I should have put it on this board. This is what happens for J unequal to K. And for J equal to K, one finds that tau J squared for every J is equal to 1, where 1 represents the unit matrix. Tau 1, if you wanted to use a matrix notation, has 1s on the off diagonal. Tau 3 has 1 and minus 1 on the diagonal. This is the same as the sigma that I talked about, except I was talking about the sigma in a diagonal representation in which it had the values 1 and minus 1. Tau 2 is defined by tau 3 times tau 1 is I tau 2. And I can never get the sign of I correct. In this, tau 2 is equal to I minus I 0, 0 times either plus or minus 1. Excuse me. If I had prepared to talk about this, I would have gotten that right probably, but I'm answering a question. This then is sort of the simplest thing you can do with quantum mechanics. These three matrices form a lovely example of Heisenberg's quantum mechanics. Their behavior is described by tau j times tau k is I times epsilon jkl summed over L times tau L plus delta jk times 1. This epsilon jkl is the completely anti-symmetric symbol of three industries. Epsilon 1, 2, 3 is equal to 1. Epsilon 3, 1, 2 is equal to 1. Epsilon 2, 3, 1 is equal to 1. You flip the sign, epsilon 2, 1 is equal to minus 1. That's what you mean by completely anti-symmetric. So this is the fundamental properties of these Pauli spin matrices. This board is now correct. This board is correct if we take J different from K. And this is a definition sufficient for understanding what those matrices do. I should describe one more thing specifically. Tau J times tau K plus tau K times tau J equals 0 if J is not equal to K. That is these guys' anti-commute. Now, this lady spoke probably for several of you who hadn't seen much of this before. Does anyone want to ask, have I been unclear about this? OK, I'm now going to do a hard calculation. I am going to imagine that I have a magnetic field in the x and y direction. I have e to the minus beta, I have a beta h, which is a magnetic field in the one direction times tau 1 plus a magnetic field in the two direction times tau 2. And I'm going to ask, what is the partition function for this guy? On this blackboard is a description of how one calculates things in quantum mechanics. What you want to do is go into a representation in which things are simple. On this board, what we have, what we have here is the probability of being in any state. So that what we have here is the statement that the average of any operator Q is the sum over alphas of e to the minus beta e alpha times Q. Divided by the sum over alpha e to the minus beta times e alpha. That's the partition function. I guess I, in order to be elegant about notation, shouldn't use the same alpha in the numerator and denominator. This numerator with a diagonal sum over alpha, that diagonal sum is called a trace. So that we have a trace in the numerator and the denominator. The denominator, what we have is the trace of e to the minus beta h. That is the sum over all possible states of the Hamiltonian value in that state, summed over all possible states. That's what a trace is. In the numerator, we have the trace of e to the minus beta h times q. And now I should feel embarrassed because I saw that there was a marking that said this wasn't such a good place for me to. Okay, that stays down. This goes up. I'm going to rewrite what I put here and just insist that it's important. The average of Q in quantum mechanics is given by the trace, that is the diagonal sum over all states, of e to the minus beta times the Hamiltonian, times that q thing, divided by the trace of e to the minus beta h, the latter being the partition function. Just to say the same thing a whole bunch of times, this is the sum over alpha, the sum over all states. If I happen to choose the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian as the states in which I will calculate that trace, this gives me an e to the minus beta times e alpha times the average of q in the states alpha divided by the partition function. I can choose to calculate the trace in any using any complete set of states I want, but this is the best choice for many purposes because it makes that e to the minus beta h factor simple. I should stop and ask you to contemplate this formula and ask questions about it because it's important.
Is this the same as
if you're given any general density matrix, what the expectation value of a density matrix would be, or the expectation of an observable.
The density matrix in quantum mechanics, it defines, you take the trace of a density matrix times any operator Q, and that gives you the average of that operator Q. Okay? The density matrix I am saying here is, in operator language, e to the minus beta h over z. Sorry to let me get a blackboard where I have enough space. This is acceptable. The density matrix in operator language is e to the minus beta h divided by z. In this is the sum of eigenstates in the Hamiltonian, sum over alpha, e to the minus beta times e alpha times alpha divided by z. So it's what you expect it to be. For people who haven't heard about the density matrix before, I should tell you that the density matrix is a general way of expressing averages in quantum mechanics, much more general than what we're doing here. There is an equilibrium value of the density matrix, a value in thermodynamic equilibrium, a value to be used in statistical mechanics, and this is it. Yes?
Letter Z and the Latin letter Z, do you mean anything different? Or?
Okay, I'm being sloppy. Thank you for catching me. I tend to use, that's my script Z, that's a lowercase z, when I'm thinking about only a few particles. And I tend to use capital Z when I'm thinking about many particles. But they mean the same thing. And this and this and this are the same physics as is this the same physics. It is the sum over all possibilities of a relative probability that you have defined. So let me answer your question by saying that the partition function Z is the sum over possibilities of the relative probabilities. So it gives you a way of normalizing the probability distribution, but is, as you will see, a general way of going after problems in statistical mechanics. Now, I wanted to calculate the partition function in this case. I'm going to show you how to do it. I'm not sure to what extent this kind of approach is familiar to people here. You've all taken a quantum mechanics course. I'm not sure whether I asked you whether you have, but if you've taken the other courses you've said you've taken, you've also taken a quantum mechanics course. But you may not have seen this way of going after it. I need the eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian. I'm going to go after it by calculating an equation obeyed by those eigenvalues. I'm going to calculate the square of this thing. I will then find that the square of this thing is very simple. I will then know what the eigenvalues of this thing are since the eigenvalues of this thing must obey the same equation as the thing itself. Let me say it again. The eigenvalues of any operator must obey the same equation as the operator does. If I take the square of this, can you see this, Mrs.? Is it okay? I'm sorry, I haven't gotten used to the room yet, and the blackboard scared me some, so I'm using the ones I haven't used. If this thing is simple, this thing will be simple. It will obey the same laws as this one does. This, I just calculate, is h1 squared times tau 1 squared. That's simple. The diagonal term h2 squared times tau 2 squared, that's simple. And then we get h1 times h2 times tau 1 tau 2 plus tau 2 tau 1. All three of these terms are simple. Tau 1 squared is 1. So I get h1 squared plus h2 squared times the unit matrix plus this anti-commutator is 0. So e to the minus beta h squared has the value h1 squared plus h2 squared. So let me call this h squared times the unit matrix, but I don't have to write the unit matrix. This is like the vector h squared. So the square of this guy has the value h squared. So this guy can only have two values. It is either plus h or minus h. So we write down minus beta h eigenvalue is either plus the vector h or minus the vector h magnitude. So the partition function, which is e to the minus beta h, the trace, the partition function, which is the trace of e to the minus beta h, is the sum over eigenvalues of e to the minus beta h, which is plus e to the plus h plus e to the minus h, which is twice the hyperbolic cosine of h as twice the hyperbolic cosine of the square root of h1 squared plus h2 squared. You will have on your homework calculation of partition functions in a quantum mechanical problem. It can be done in more or less this fashion. There's one more homework thing that we have to catch up on, and I'm about to do that right now. I got done in because I was going to have it. Okay, I'm sorry. Let me pause for a moment. I am going to take another 15 minutes of your time. Is this calculation clear? Yes, please. Thank you. It's a good question. Excellent question. I know the eigenvalues are different in the following way. Let me write Q is H1 tau 1 plus H2 tau 2. Trace Q. Now, I know what the trace of this H1 times the trace of tau 1 plus H2 times the trace of tau 2. And I can use stuff which I erased, but the tau, oh, here they are. Tau 1 has no diagonal components. Its trace is 0. Tau 2 has no diagonal components. Its trace is 0. So the trace of Q is equal to 0. The trace of Q is the is one eigenvalue of Q plus the other eigenvalue of Q. If they go to sum to 0, and they're going to have one which is non-zero, you've got to have the other one have the opposite sign. That was a good question. And I didn't give you enough information to fully answer what the trace would, what the partition function would turn out to be. So this calculation is necessary in order to get the answer. There's another way of getting the answer, which you will regard perhaps as not very nice. I will calculate what happens when H2 is 0. When H2 is 0, I know what happens because the tau 1 matrix is a diagonal. The tau 1 matrix being diagonal means that I know exactly what's going on. That is, that the trace is that the trace, for example, is 0, or that the eigenvalues are plus or minus 1, because I know what the eigenvalues of tau 1 are. I then use continuity. I say, well, the answer is not going to be qualitatively different if H2 is different from 0. It's going to be qualitatively similar. You're going to get you have a sort of analytic continuation to go from one answer to the other. That those, either you wave your hands around with the smoothness argument, or you do the actual calculation with the trace argument, but either way, you get the answer. Now, what I'm trying to convince you on this blackboard is that there is a way of doing calculations in quantum mechanics which is probably different from the way you did it in your undergraduate courses. In your undergraduate courses, you did wave functions and calculated eigenvalues by first calculating the wave function and then, or probably. These operator methods in quantum mechanics are good methods and get you answers more quickly often than do the wave function methods. However, I've promised you one more topic. I wanted to talk about something which is going to appear on the homework, and I should I got one last clean blackboard to play with. One last clean half blackboard to play with. No, not clean. It's okay. We'll make it clean. I talked to you before my computer quit on me, about model problems. There's one more model problem that I wanted to talk about because it had a very important role in statistical physics. Lorenz talked about a ordinary differential equation model that produced chaos. And that's a pretty simple model. However, there is a simpler model that produces chaos, and it appears on your homework, so I have to tell you about it. Imagine that I calculate some variable x. Imagine, for example, x represents the number of insects that exist on an island. And the number of insects that exist on that island changes because the insects die off and get born in every year. And so the number of insects that appear in year j plus 1 is the number of insects that appear in year j times a population growth factor called R. That model itself is not so interesting. Xj has the solution that it's x naught times r to the j. It's exponential growth, and you know all about it. So let me make the model a little more interesting. Imagine that there is something going on which is bad for the insects. S stands for something, is a parameter that represents what is the bad thing. That bad thing is proportional to the amount of crowding between the insects in year j. So it's proportional to xj squared. So now we have a model which looks like this and is not trivial, not trivial at all. I will make the change of variables. X goes into x over s, and the model looks like xj plus 1 is r times xj, r times x over s, xj times 1 minus xj. This r over s is a sort of maximum population for the island, and this says more or less that this is a population ratio. The ratio of the population to the maximum the island can hold. And now I was going to use the computer and the computer models to tell you about what happens with this model. But I don't need the computer to do that. I can just tell you. For r between 0 and 1, what happens is that if I plot xj as a function of j, so let me do it. Here's the first year, here's the second year, the third year, the fourth year, the fifth year. For r between 0 and 1, there's nothing that causes the growth of insects, and the r factor is less than 1, so that the population decays year by year. And so that what happens is that xj goes to 0 as j goes to infinity. I'm going to start with xj. I'm always going to work with xj in the interval 0, 1. In fact, I will choose xj in the interval 0, 1, not including 0 and 1, because if I start out with no insects, I never get any. And if I start out with the insects being at their maximum population, they all die off. And then in successive years, I never get any. I didn't understand your question, but I will answer it nonetheless, just showing what sort of person I am. That is, xj is the ratio of the population to the maximum population. Now ask your question again. And I will try to answer the right question.
Well, I was asking what is
infinity. Good. So although I'm not a good listener, I'm a good mind reader, so that's OK. Excuse me? Because if I start out at that maximum population, it goes because the model works in the for x in the interval 0, 1. If I push x to be bigger than if I use this equation and push x to be bigger than 1, I get negative populations. I get all embarrassed, and I have to stop talking. Similarly, if I choose x less than 0, well. OK, now for r between 1 and I'm not actually sure of my numbers now, but let me tell you what happens. Xj starting in the interval 0, 1 for r in this interval goes to a constant as j goes to infinity. In fact, we can calculate that constant, which if xj goes to a constant, it will have obey the equation x star times 1 minus x star, which is solved to get x star is 1 over r. And so here are two very orderly behaviors. If r is between 2 and 3.3, maybe. I'm not at all confident of this number. Then you get a behavior which is different from that. Here's j. Here's xj. And I'll plot it out year by year. It starts out with something. It goes up to something. It goes and then alternates high, low, high, low, high, low. That is, in a good year, there aren't many insects around. The insects multiply like mad, and one gets a high value. That means the next year is a sort of bad year. There are lots of insects around. This 1 minus x factor counts for a lot, and the population drops. And so you get a zigzag population versus time looking like this. Well, because we have it built in as a period, annual change, there's no period as 1 year or 2 years, depending on how you view it. Yes, I'm listening. I didn't understand the question. I'm having that x star. That's a stable result. That is, if I choose x star to be a little different from, if I choose x to be a little different from x star, nonetheless, it will return to x star.
It should be 1 minus 1 over r.
Thank you. That's what happens when you... haven't prepared properly. I was prepared to do this on the computer. Thank you very much. Thanks for rescuing me. The words I said were right, the equation was wrong. Now you go up a little bit further, and you start to get, first this is period 2, then a little higher value of r, you get period 4. The thing repeats itself after 4 years. A little higher value of r than that, you get period 8. It repeats itself after 8 years. 16, 32, and then you get a sort of chaotic behavior. The chaos is partial until at r equals 4, which appears on your homework, there is a very full and rich chaos, which you can analyze analytically. You can do the r equals 4 case analytically. I suggest waste your time trying to do too many of the other cases analytically. Analytic stuff can be done through the period 4, but beyond that, I believe it's extremely hard to do any analytic stuff, and the period 3s or the chaos or the other stuff that occurs is impossible to analyze nicely. So this is something that appears on your homework. I did have set up a nice pictures of this on the computer. I will, when I get a chance to work a little more with the computer people here, come back and try to show you the pictures that you all missed today. Questions or comments? Let me spend a second summarizing what's important. The important thing is that the probabilities we compute are of the form of an a priori probability which has an e to the minus beta times the energy in it. That a priori probability is then normalized by what is called a partition function, z, which gives us a technique for calculating what then comes out from the statistical mechanics, as you will see starting next time. By doing different derivatives of z, you can calculate averages. One such derivative appears in the homework. I suspect the tutor will show you how that derivative of z produces an average value. Are there questions about the lecture? Enjoy lunch.